We are at the 4.2 lesson. That makes a lot. No. Okay. And unfortunately, I have something to tell you still on the catalog of transcription. So we start the alternative splicing mechanism in 20 minutes or something. But I have something left from Monday, and I think that probably it's better to discuss shortly. So the agenda of today is other transcripts from the catalog, and then the discussion of what is a gene today. That is a kind of discussion that is going through the scientific field today. Then the pausing of RNA polymerase, that actually is a kind of lesson that should be placed in the other chapter 3, but actually came out from this kind of studies. So. And then we start to discuss extensive alternative splicing, mechanism of exon splicing, and cis-regulatory sequences, transacting factor, and tissue-specific regulators. So this is the... So starting from the RNA catalog, and if you go to here, to GeneCode, and try to just to ask for the statistics. So I don't do it. I mean, you're just a suggestion to do it. And you click on statistics, you will see how many kind of RNA are described and cataloged. Okay, so this is a kind of story because, as I told you on Monday, with this kind of extensive transcriptome analysis that people are doing today, we are continuously discovering transcripts and continuously trying to catalog those molecules, even though the function of them is so unknown. I mean, we actually know functional meaning of those for very few of them. So don't be surprised if you always continue to see some terms that actually are just tentative classification until a function for those RNA will be discovered and proved for in some cases. Okay, so I just took one discussion from this review that is quite old. Actually, it was published just the year before ENCODE was published, so it's a kind of comment on those results. And some of these stories, especially the numbers there, have been changed in the last 5 years. But anyway, I think it's a good point to start. So what is that if you make a very general catalog of the story, you find protein coding gene, of course, and then you have other stories that are unprocessed pseudogene and processed pseudogene. We discussed it in the genomics, all right? And sometimes they are transcribed. So sometimes you find actually transcription from these processed or unprocessed pseudogenes. Then you find also this what is called unitary pseudogene, that it means that there are few events in which the pseudogene have no gene homolog. So probably they are copies of an ancient gene that has been lost during evolution. And sometimes also you find transcription out of those. Then you find different kind of long non-coding RNAs, LNC RNA, and are divided in sense intronic. So they are entirely contained in intron of a protein coding gene, or sometimes also these guys here. Okay, but are sense, so they are transcribed in the same sense as the protein coding gene itself. Okay, starting from a different promoter, of course, because they are placed something like here. Okay. Then the second category is antisense long non-coding RNAs that can be variously overlapping a protein coding gene, in the sense that there are events in which you have just few bases. They are transcribed on the left, okay? On the left, while the protein coding gene here in this picture is transcribed on the right, okay? and they can have an overlap of few nucleotides just at the start, or sometimes they overlap extensively to the protein-coding gene. Okay. Also, you have cases in which the antisense long non-coding RNA stays in a intron. You will see a case after. Okay. Third, a special category of long non-coding RNA is this LINC RNA. That means long intergenic. That means that they are placed in some place of the genome in which we didn't annotate any other gene before. Okay, so they are in intergenic space. Okay, and these are the numbers at that point. And then finally, all these are classified as a long non-coding genes or coding. Okay, and then we have small non-coding RNAs that, as you know, they contain mostly the microRNA. We will discuss in the next lesson. But also they contain different kinds of small RNA, like, for example, the uRNA that are component of the splices. They are non-coding RNA. They have a function. Okay, so they are classified over there. Small non-coding RNA can be placed everywhere in the genome. They can be either in intergenic spaces. They can stay in introns of the genes. They can stay in the introns of the non-coding RNA. They are around, okay, without any kind of criteria. You will see. So the problem is that, as you probably have seen exploring the browser in the exercise that you made in the lab, there are some perplexing stories. Since you essentially, we find transcripts everywhere in the genome with the orders, any kind of order that you can see. So it makes very difficult today to make a discussion of what is a gene. Because, I mean, 10 years ago was very easy. A gene was a protein coding something, okay, a transcription unit, making RNA and making a protein. And this discussion was actually made in this review. And actually, it takes comparison of what's the classical model versus what is the model today. And the classical model, everybody knows. Okay, so if you have a gene, you have exons and introns, promoters, and whatever, and then you make RNA, you make splicing, and then you get a coding sequence, and you make a polypeptide. This is the classical model. However, when you look in the genome browsers today, and it's an experience that everybody can do, very easily. You just explore whatever. Ask for any gene that you know in your mind and then look for the genomic region. You will see very complex situation like this one that is completely hypothetical. It's just an average that the author of this review they made on making the sum of what you can see in the genome. Like this gene, hypothetical gene, in which you see there is a protein coding gene. Okay, that is here, this one, okay, is placed here, starting from here to there, transcribed from the left to the right, okay, this is the direction of the main transcript, okay, and this is a protein coding gene, has a alternative splicing here in the middle, normal, we know that, we are confident with it, no problem. The problem is that together with these two protein coding transcripts, you also find a non-coding one. And this, again, is a very common situation. If you look for virtually any gene today, just asking the database for a protein coding, you will find a list of transcripts in which at least one of those is non-coding. Okay, so it's so common. And this actually arose from alternative splicing here, in which apparently this alternative splicing put everything out of frame, so no, the ORF is no longer present. Okay, so this is a non-coding. It's completely overlapped with the protein coding unit, okay, but it's non-coding. Then you discover another transcript also that is made in this in sense strain, okay, and that is this one, the 7 here. You see there is a alternative promoter, and again is a very common situation, an alternative promoter somewhere, okay? And note, please, that after this alternative promoter, there's an alternative exon here, okay? So it's completely different from the exon here, okay? Then you splice it to common exons, okay? So this transcript starts there, takes out an exon, then it jumps to the common exon. This is a constitutive exon, of course. It's present in all the transcripts, okay? Then you go to the second one that is the same as here. Then you go to the there, okay? This happens again something strange, so you don't jump to the final exon. But look at this. Far, very far, 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 far away, there is another exon. And this transcript is spliced to this far exon there, where there is a pre-termination codon, okay? So the ORF starts from here, the green one, okay, and stops there. Then this guy is spliced with another couple of exons that are even further downstream here, okay? So you find an enormous transcript here. The protein coding region is partly in common with this protein here, and partly is completely different, okay? So the story is not finished. The story is not finished because if you look at this, there is another transcript that actually starts from a promoter that is intronic here, okay? And that makes an exon that is completely excluded from the other one, okay? And then it takes this exon here, exactly the same. And also exactly the same exon that terminates the very long transcript over there. Except that, of course, since this starts from another point, at this point you have a frame. Okay? So these exons were completely non-coding because here you have a pre-termination coded. Okay? But here you start from this point and then you get a transcription ORF, so a coding region here. This protein is protein because it's green, is again completely different from that one and from those one. Okay, it's another protein, even though the transcript is partially overlapping with another one, the transcript. Okay, then it's not finished because we discovered another transcript going in the antisense. And this is a non-coding because it's pink, as you can see. So this is a non-coding, is overlapped with this region. So it's one of these antisense long non-coding RNA that goes in the other direction. So now, finally, we have finished this model, this story, and the question is, what is a gene? So we were used to associate a gene with something, one object, but apparently it's not one object. You have at least 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 separate objects. Okay, of those, 3, 4 encodes for a protein. So that's a kind of problem. And apparently there is a discussion in the textbook that you have for long non-coding RNAs in which they say, actually, as far as we continue to describe transcript in different cells, the idea is that today you have a kind of continuous transcription over the genome with no real difference in between the parts. And then you have something that is functional and something that is not, okay? So it's a kind of changing panorama, okay? So we are really to change our mind from the classical concept of gene to the something a little different, okay? Don't be surprised. This is biology, so we have to do it. Okay, in addition, because the study is not finished. In addition, when people made all this kind of strange sequencing like CAGE, SAGE, we describe these kind of small tags sequencing and small stories, people have found a number of unstable short RNAs that are close to promoters or to determination also, okay? So there was a a review in that period that was showing something like this. So this is a transcription unit, say, I don't know if gene or whatever, so this classical transcription starts from here, going this direction. And so this is the main long transcript from this gene. And then you associate, when you make short sequencing, you find a number of small transcripts here and a small transcript there, and sometimes also something close to the termination, and sometimes also transcript here. Now, transcript there, the long ones are usually, today we associate them with other transcripts that are in the upstream region. These small stories here actually probably reflect a kind of abortive transcription of the RNA polymerase. What the scientists studying this kind of story today, they say the polymerase sits on the promoter and then starts transcribing on the left and the right, aborting. So just making sure transcript that then it falls down, because probably the polymerase has not all the factors that are needed to make elongation. Okay? And so these that are probably thought like this one. This category, on the contrary, is a little perplexing, because it is quite abundant. And also, by associating this kind of transcript with other technologies, like, for example, GrowSeq, that you have probably sometimes heard about. GrowSeq is a technology that actually measures the transcription during the transcription itself. Usually when you make RNA preparation, what you do is to extract RNA from the cell, right? Okay? Whenever you make a PCR or sequencing or whatever, you take the RNA from the cell. So it means that you are looking to a steady state situation. You don't know transcription. The RNA is there, you see it, you don't know where, when it has been transcribed, okay? So the GrowSeq is a different concept, because it actually is like making a picture of where the RNA polymerase is, okay? So the method is that you take a cell, okay, you cool it down to 0 degrees or something, that is a temperature that doesn't allow the polymerase to go through, okay, so you kind of freezing the situation. Then you isolate the nuclei, simple story, okay, technically, and then you add labeled nucleotide to the nuclei, okay? You can, when I was working in the lab several years ago, I was using a radioactive compound to make this. Today we use a different story. We use biotinylated, or like bromo, UTP, or whatever. I mean, other things that are not necessarily radioactive. Okay, so you add this kind of label, and then you rise a little bit the temperature. Okay, for a few minutes. The time necessary for the polymerase to move a little bit ahead. Okay, so the RNA polymerase that has already started goes away, okay, elongate a little bit for a few minutes, whatever you like. I mean, you can do it for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, depending on the kind of experiment you want to do, and then you stop it again, okay? So you stop and then at this point you hydrolyze to make short fragments, and then you can, of course, if you extract the RNA from the cell here, you have both the newly labeled RNA and the pre-existing RNA. But since you have labeled it, you can purify. Okay, so you use, for example, if you use a biotin over there, okay, you can use a streptavidin. In this case, they use bromo DUTP, and they use anti-bromo-UTP, whatever. I mean, you can label whatever, and then you can isolate only those small fragments that are being elongated by the polymerase during the pulse period, okay? So at this point, of course, you elute, okay, and then you reverse transcribe, make cDNA, and the illumina, OK? Okay? So you make sequencing. At this point, you have sequences that are of RNA that have been transcribed during this small period of time. Okay? So the polymerase can be wherever in the gene node. Okay? So you are freezing the situation. So you can measure whatever is the fragment. Okay? So you think that probably, since usually you have a starting point, a starting phase that is quite slow, as you probably remember from the books. So the polymerase starts very slowly. Then she has, so she polymerase is, I don't know, it's a female or male. It associates, sorry, the object. It associates the elongation factor, and so it has a productive elongation. So what you see normally is that you have a peak close to the promoter. Okay. So what it came out is that using this kind of technology, people showed very clearly what is called the promoter proximal pausing of the polymerase. Okay, so this is actually a very old phenomenon that was described something like 25 years ago, something studying the heat shock genes. You know what are heat shock genes? Genes that respond with chaperones production whenever you have a rise, a stress to the cell, actually heat. Okay? And they have chaperones, so they try to avoid the denaturation of the proteins. So in those cases, it was described that in those genes, the polymerase starts from the promoter. This is the classical promoter. And then it goes to a point that is usually no longer than 100 base pairs. Okay, so it makes a short tract, and then it stops there. And it's found there, exactly there. Okay, so no any other advancement. And so you have a short RNA. Okay, over there. And then this positive polymerase can start again after a while. In the heat shock genes, it was demonstrated that when you heat shock the cell, the polymerase starts again. Okay? So finishing transcribing the genes that encode for these chaperones that will help the non-denaturation of proteins. Okay. So there are other two cases that were being described in the past, that are the arrested polymerase, in which actually polymerase makes a kind of step back. So after arriving to this point, the polymerase step backs a little bit, okay, and then it cleaves off this fragment and then starts again. And this is called arrested polymerase, not paused. And then there is the termination. I mean, sometimes when the pause is too long and the polymerase cannot start anymore, it will dissociate from the template, okay? And this probably produces this small RNA that we were talking about before. So polymerase starts, is arrested, cannot start anymore, and so it releases this abortive tract of RNA. This is probably what we were describing before, okay? This and this, okay? So, coming to the paused polymerase, that is the most interesting story, is that when the people started to make gross-seq, they found that for a number of genes, the very high peak of gross-seq fragments was actually coming not from the promoter, but exactly from this paused region. So you have a very high peak of transcript of gross-seq that is exactly localized to something like 30 to 50 to 60 base pair after the promoter. And so this testifies that you have a number of polymerase that are there, okay? Stop there. So when you resume transcription, you have a peak of those. So this is also evident if you make, of course, polymerase 2 chip seq. So if you try to localize the polymerase, okay, by making a chip seq. Okay. And so you find this situation. You find genes in which you have a peak of the polymerase. This is a gene, all right? Okay, this is the map of the gene. So you find a very high signal of the polymerase in the first part of the gene, okay? And you find also a number of other positions occupied by the polymerase, and this means that this gene is transcribed, but most of the RNA polymerase molecules are posed, as you saw before, okay? And this is the posing index. Actually, posing index is the number of polymerase that you find in the first 100 bases as compared to the total polymerase on the gene, okay? So this is another situation in which you have a little less posing, you see? The posing index is a little lower, but anyway, you still find a peak over there. This is another gene. Just examples. Then you find also the classical situation of heat shock genes that I told you before. So genes in which there is no transcription because the cell is not shocked, so there is no reason to express heat shock proteins, okay? But you have all the polymerase stuck to the first zone, the first tract. And you see the situation here. So you have a very high peak of the polymerase then, and then very, very, very low polymerase all through the gene. So this is a posing index of 21.7, as you can see. And this is the classical situation of posed but inactive genes. Okay? And then you have non-posed genes. This is a clear example of a gene here in which the polymerase is all through the gene. So the posing index is very low, means that actually you don't have any posing at the first exon. Okay? And then you have non-posed, non-expressed, so no polymerase all through the gene. So no pose, not expressed. Okay? So we've seen all these kind of phenomena looking for the transcript in around, especially for the joining the Gross-Seq results with the ChIP-Seq results. Okay? What is the mechanism is that has been described. Actually, the mechanism is that after the initiation, so you have general transcription factor and chromatin remodeler here, so you discover that TSS is free, and then the polymerase starts to make transcription here, and at this point, it reaches the pose region, you can see here, and actually, this is not spontaneous. It depends on two proteins that are called NELF and DSIF. These two proteins associate to the polymerase and stop the polymerase over there. So they are stopping factors. Okay. At this point, you wait, and the pose release actually is linked to the arrival of another factor that is called PTFB, that actually is a kinase. So it phosphorylates a number of positions. It phosphorylates actually the DSIF protein, and this makes the NELF to dissociate from it. Okay? And this phosphorylation to DSIF also converts DSIF from an inhibitory factor to an elongation factor. So actually, at this point, the polymerase starts again, okay? Or you can have phosphorylated, this PTFB also phosphorylated the second position in the C-terminal domain of the polymerase. As you remember, this is very important. I don't know if you remember, maybe you don't, but the RNA polymerase, when it starts, has to be phosphorylated in this position of the repeats in the CTD. Okay, and usually you have initial phosphorylation by this kinase there, then the polymerase proceeds and this gets additional phosphorylation in position 2 and position 5. Okay, this position 2 is critical because this position 2 associates with set D2 protein, that is the methyl transferase that methylates position K36, that is essential for going ahead. Okay, then through the cycle, this position get partially dephosphorylated, okay, these inhibitory factors there, and then when you arrive to termination, you have release of this phosphorylation there, okay, so that's the cycle. So to come back, this PTFB also phosphorylated the necessary position that is here in position 2, that actually makes the polymerase to progress to the transcription, okay? So that's the story. And why there is this kind of function of, I mean, why the evolution, please note also that, for example, the very low eukaryotes, they don't do pausing. Yeast, for example, has no pausing. So it's something that evolved after, in some way, okay? So in higher eukaryotes, and maybe that, okay, there are only hypotheses. Maybe one of the hypotheses is that the fact that the polymerase stops there means that you cannot establish, you remember the famous plus one nucleosomes that is always sitting in that position. So if you have the polymerase there, you cannot see the nucleosome. So this means probably that this gene to be reactivated doesn't need to have ATP remodelers. You remember the ATP chromatin remodelers to get rid of these nucleosomes. This is one of the story. Also, this is probably necessary to bind additional transcription factor or whatever. So this is one hypothesis. The second hypothesis is that if you have a number of genes, and this is the hypothesis for the heat shock chaperones that I told you before. So you have to activate immediately some genes without need of mounting all these transcription factors, general transcription factor, peak components, blah, blah. So you need an immediate response. And so in that case, the genes are stopped there, and then they are synchronously activated just when the PTFB is activated. So this is one of the reasons. Then another point is that integration of signals, so you may have signals going to the basal component and to removing the pausing, or other hypotheses like checkpoint in the elongation, other things. But just stop the story there. So there are many hypotheses. But the take-home message is that this is is not a casual, random event, okay? It has been evolved in higher eukaryotes, apparently to make something. This is the reason. Okay. So the parenthesis is closed now. Okay, and starting again with the statistic or the gene code, we can start again and go to the real content of the lesson today, that is alternative splicing. And the first thing that you will read on one of your textbook is that the long non-coding RNA make much more alternative splicing than protein-coding genes. In other terms, I told you that protein-coding genes, they have alternative splicing usually of 1 to 2 exons maximum in a gene. Okay, while looking for the long non-coding RNA genes, we always find many more situations. And this is in apparent contrast to what you see on gene code, because gene code, if you look at this story, they say that they verified and validated 16,000 long non-coding RNA genes, right? Okay, this is 16,000. And when you look at the transcript, they say long non-coding RNA lossy transcript is 30,000. So it makes something like twice, even not twice, right? So 2 transcripts per gene. Is that correct? Then if you look at protein coding genes, I see 20,000, correct? And if I look at the transcript of, protein coding transcript, I see 83,000. So it seems the other way around. It seems that we have much more alternative transcript here than here. The problem is how we talk about on Monday. The problem is how to map very low expressed genes. Okay, so just to remind you that most, you remember that mountains that we saw on the the paperless days. So most of the London coding RNA are extremely low expression, so it's very difficult to say this has a isoform, has not a isoform. It's extremely important. So this is just to resolve this apparent contradiction between the numbers in the ENCODE and what the reviews say in their text. So the long RNA undergo alternative splicing. They are capped and polyadenylated exactly as the other guys are. And one problem is, what is the sense of making alternative splicing of something that doesn't encode anything? And actually, from the few things that we know for long non-coding genes, I mean, in the few instances in which we resolved the function, you will see, of long non-coding RNA, they have actually functional parts. Like in this image, I say, okay, this part of the long non-coding interacts with protein 1, and the second one targets another story, another protein, another RNA or whatever, and the target B, this part will, for example, localize the RNA in a different cellular component, whatever. So, of course, if you make alternative splicing isoforms containing only parts of this story, you make different functions out of this long non-coding RNA. Okay, so even though we know that this is really spectacular, because, I mean, this is 16,000. We know the function may be of 6 of them, 7. So it's something like saying to try to imagine at the moment. Okay, not really saying something true. Anyway, that's the story. Okay. So the alternative splicing is guided by the same elements of protein coding RNAs that we study in a moment. Okay, and I told you that they have usually less exons, okay, but more alternative. Okay. Of course, the more alternative are justified by the fact that, of course, protein coding genes, they have constrained by the fact that the ORF has to be maintained. I mean, the famous three-letter code has to be maintained. Long non-coding RNA probably escape from this rule, so they can interchange much easier than in the protein coding gene. Okay? So let me just take an example again. This is your famous DSCAM gene that you study on the browser. And this is the gene. Sorry, this is the gene. This is a huge gene, as you remember. This is something like we have 40 million here. It's 4,800. So it makes 800 KB, something like this. It's enormous, really, with a number of exons. So in this intron here, okay, there, we have a antisense non-coding RNA, this guy here. Note that this is from the right to the left transcription. I mean, the host gene, this DSCAM, is from the right to the left in this image, okay? And this is just the zoom out of this small RNA here, okay? And it's transcribed in this sense. Now, if you look at this guy that is called a DSCAM antisense 1, you see here that is has an enormous number of splicing forms here. It's a kind of mess here, because you are splicing starting from here to there, then another splicing is starting a little bit farther here and going to this point here, including this exon that is exclusive to this form, then again from here to there, and then here, and then this part is kind of cryptic intron here that is spliced out in this transcript. So we have many forms we don't know anything about. The only story that we know is that when this form here with the exon inside, this middle exon, it localizes only the nuclei. So this isoform here stays in the nuclei, while the other three forms are in the cytoplasm. So apparently this exon here contains something that will keep the RNA in the nuclei. We don't know anything about the function of this. This is absolutely specific. Is that specific to cancer cells? No normal cell express it. It's specific to breast cancer, so no other cancer cells express it. Okay, and it's specific to a subtype of breast cancer. So it makes a kind of very, I told you on Monday, very often this long non-coding RNA like absolutely cell type specific. So it's kind of mystery. Anyway, just to tell you the story. So, splicing. Start with splicing and say what it is, how it works. The first question is, what do we know of splicing? What do you know of splicing? I don't know. I hope much. And when is the splicing? Where? How? And especially this question here. Is that co-transcriptional or post-transcriptional? What you know about? Is anybody of you expressing an opinion on this question? No one. No idea. We can make a vote. Who is voting for co-transcriptional? Vote. Who is voting for post-transcriptional? And the other one, non responde. This is a long-standing question, also a little weird, actually, because it's kind of, you know, if it's born first the egg or the chicken, something like this, because probably in biology the story are never yes or not, black and white, there will be something in between. But anyway, this is a question that actually has many things to do with the mechanism of splicing. So let's see how the ENCODE guys that we have studied already resolved this problem. Okay? So they took this, one of the 15 cell lines that they examined by RNA-seq on Monday, okay, this K562 cell line, and they analyzed also RNA from the three subnuclear compartments. It's a very special technology. Not many people in the world know exactly how to separate these fractions that are chromatin, nucleolus, and nucleoplasm. Okay? But anyway, they did. And they found that almost all the annotated genes were identified in all the three fractions. Okay. So this is the resume of what you read there. Also, as far as concerning the novel annotated genes of ENCODE, so the discoveries. Okay. Then they interrogate this different subcellular RNA fraction in order to see whether where the intron is present. Okay, so the reasoning is that, imagine, if the splicing is post-transcriptional, means that you have to make all the RNA, right? Then you stop transcription, the RNA is released, and then the splicing takes place. Okay? So you will find essentially all the introns in the chromatin during transcription. You should see all the introns there, right? And you see fraction of the introns in the nucleoplasm. Okay, during removal. Okay? If on the other hypothesis, transcription and splicing proceed together, it means that many of the introns are removed in the chromatin fraction when the polymerase is still attached to the chromatin during transcription. Okay? So at this point, they substantially used this RNA-seq to measure the degree of completion, and they observed that around most exon introns are already being spliced in the chromatin-associated RNA. Okay, so many of the introns are already being spliced, so they disappear from the chromatin-associated factor fraction. Okay, so this is something like that. How they measure that? It's not very difficult. They actually took all the data that they have. So I remember to you chromatin-associated RNA. So they isolated chromatin, they extracted RNA, or nucleoplasm. So no chromatin, only the soluble fraction of the nuclei, and nucleolus. RNA-seq of all them. Okay, and then you can map from the reads. You can map events. Okay, so you have, for example, the case in which this is something like having 1, 2, 3, 4 exon, 1 exon here, 1 exon here. Okay, so you can measure, these are exons, sorry. These are exon, 1 exon, 2 exon, 3. And these are the reads that you can have. Okay, you can have either exonic reads that are not depicted in this figure, or you can have splicing reads that are either this one. A means that you have a part of this exon, a part of this exon, right? Okay, this is a junction read, as you learn to call it last lesson. This B, same. This B maps to this exon here and part to the other exon, so it's a splicing read again. Okay. Then you can have a skipping exon event, right? So this exon is not included, and in that case you may have reads that have part here and part here. Okay? So they are A, B, and C, they are called splicing reads. Okay? Then you can measure the inclusion of introns, so you still have introns in your RNA, by looking for these reads here that are part on the exon and part on the intron. Okay, in between the exon and exon you have intron. Okay, and this is the same story, exon, intron. Okay, so these are called junction reads, and these are called exon intron junction reads. Okay, so for each exon, taking care of the central exon here, they made a ratio. So they summed the reads that are splicing reads, A plus B plus C, and they divided this amount by the exon by the exon intron reads. So D plus E. Okay? So A plus C plus B divided by D plus E. Okay, and this gives you a ratio that is actually the ratio of splicing. As higher is this sum A plus B plus C as compared to D and D, means that the splicing has been completed. Okay, so you measure this Cauchy ratio. Okay, so when you have a high Cauchy ratio, means that it's spliced. Okay. When you have a low Cauchy ratio, means unspliced. Okay? Follow? It's not really very difficult. Okay? So now you can plot the Cauchy index that you found for any exon, all the exons of the genome. You can put over the frequency that you find. Okay? And so this is the chromatin fraction you see here, and this is the cytosol fraction. In cytosol, almost all the splicing has been done, of course. Okay, so in cytosol we expect to have very low amount of interest. Is that correct? And in fact, as you can see, the maximum frequency is Cauchy 1. That means everything has been spliced out. Very few interest there remaining. Okay? If you look at the chromatin now, so chromatin-associated RNA, if the hypothesis of non-cotranscriptional splicing was true, you expect to have zero. Okay? You expect to have all the introns there. So the fraction, the D plus E, to be much higher than the splicing event. So very low COSY. So you expect to have a big peak here, and on the contrary, it's exactly the opposite way. So you find a COSY that is almost completely one in all these parts, and then going slowly down. So anyway, to make the story short, they could demonstrate by making this kind of fraction in RNA-seq that almost all splicing is co-transcription. So during transcription, okay? So this is what's important to understand the reason, because when you will read and study this Alberto Korblik review that I suggested to you as a textbook for alternative splicing, almost all the discussion that he makes about alternative splicing mechanism is based on this concept. It's based on the fact that the splicing is co-transcriptional, okay? A note that is important to discuss before stopping for 5 minutes is the note that when I say co-transcriptional, when he says, actually, I am not a specialist in splicing, it doesn't mean that it's as soon as the RNA is out of the polymerase, okay? The polymerase goes through the gene, okay? And makes transcription, okay? So you, from the polymerase, you will see emerging the first exon, then the first intron, correct? Then the second exon. So you can make a splicing of this intron, okay? And then the second intron, blah, 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 blah. Being co-transcriptional means that the RNA is still doing the RNA while the splicing is done. But do not expect that the first intron is removed as soon as it is transcribed. We have many cases in which the intron waits for a longer tract of transcription to have another intron to compete with it, you will see, and other exons to compete with it. Otherwise, you cannot explain alternative splicing. Okay? Good. Can we stop for 5 minutes or something? Vista, hasta la vista, hasta la vista. So, okay, can start back, please? If you finish your discussions, thank you. So, okay, this is just the textbook. A note on the textbook. There are many stories that are interesting, especially in the boxes, yellow boxes, that are explaining different stories. And in the figures, in the legend of the figures. Then in the text there are many, many reports of experiments, but you have to take care that this is is not really very recent. Okay? So as far as the mechanisms are concerned, the figures that explain the mechanisms, and so everything good in the text. Whenever you find long stories about reporting different experiments, you can probably just take it as anecdotal. Okay, it's not really the very last story. So okay, we use the first figure of this textbook to understand if you remember something about the splicing. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. This is very basic splicing, not alternative splicing. Basic splicing. You remember probably something of this? Yeah? No? Yeah? So you have an initial recognition of introns, exon. Do you know what are you? One, SNRP. You pronounce it SNRP. Do you remember? More or less. Please say yes or not. You don't. That's great. Okay. So you have a Okay, I explain you what are these nerves. Nerves are component of the spliceosome, okay? And they are big proteins, complex, together with one molecule of RNA that are called U. U1, U2, U4, U5, U6, and so on. So they are small non-coding RNAs that make integral part of this nerve, okay? Want to see a table? I show you the table so you're convinced. This is nerve 1, or call it U1, okay? It contains one molecule of RNA U that is 53 kilodaltons, and then you have 7 proteins like this one that are called SNR B, BDU, don't make me making the directory of telephone. Okay, so, and then other proteins. So this makes all these together, they make SNRP 1. Okay? Then you have SNRP 2 that is made up by RNA U2. That is a small non-coding RNA, 61 K Dalton, and then all these protein here. You can see? So it's enormous, just to say, it's an enormous complex with many subunits. This is U5, and this is U4-6, and so on, okay? So each of these small bolts that you see on the figure is the complex that you saw on the table, okay? So this complex, U1's nerve, recognizes the 5' splice site. So these few nucleotides that are just in the border between the exon and the intron. Okay? Don't be surprised of these letters. You see this A-G-G-U-R. A-G-U, what is R? What is R? I mean, R, I remember to you that we have a code, I told you already. So a part of the 4 normal letters that you always see in a sequence, whenever you have either one or the other of the pyrimidine, you can say Y. Whenever you have either A or G of the purine, you can say R. Okay? Then you can, if you have an A or T, since they are only 2 hydrogen bonding, they are called weak, so W for weak. Okay? G or C makes strong. Keto, if they have an oxygen keto group in the base, so the T and G, they have a keto base, or amino, that is the C and A, they have an amino substitution, so they are called M. Then we have this kind of funny letters here. If you have A, G or T, it means not C, so it's a D. If you have A and G, not T, it means not T, so a V, and blah, blah. Okay, so these are the symbols that are used when you have to describe a sequence that is a little variable. So when you see this kind of sequence here, it means that you have any purine in this position, okay? Or here, any pyrimidine. N means everything, okay? Good. Okay. So this is the U1 is nerve that recognizes this site. And then the other important sites of the intronexon are recognized, this 3' splice site, so the ending part of the intron, is recognized by 2 proteins that are not component of this nerve, of the spliceosome, and they are called U2 associated factor. They are 2 subunit proteins. One of those, the U2AF35, its job is to recognize the AG that always terminates the introns, okay? While the U2AF62 will recognize this polypyrimidine tract that always precedes the AG, okay? So in the terminal part of the introns, you always find polypyrimidine and then AG, okay? So this other protein that is BBP, that means branch site binding protein, will recognize the site where you remember that the the intron is removed as a lariat, so it makes a branching, and this branching point is a very poorly conserved sequence, as you can appreciate here. And this A is the one that makes the branch. Okay, so this protein will recognize the branching site. So the very first complex that you find during transcription is that these proteins will bind to the essential part of the intron. Okay? Okay. Once you have this situation, okay, you associate other components, you dissociate these two guys. Okay? So this U2 AF go away. And you associate the BPP goes away also, and you associate the second SNRN, that is the U2 SNRN, but it's also the largest one, you remember, this one with all these components. Okay? So this U2 SNRN will sit on the branching side, okay? And at this point you have the complex assembly. So the other U4, U6 will join the complex, okay? And the U5 also, okay, you see there. So this is the splices. This is a big component. You can see by the electronic microscopy, it's as big as a ribosome. Okay? So you see it like this. And at this point, you have the first reaction. That is, as you remember, is that you make a lariat, okay? So this border here of the intron is transferred to this A. Actually, from the biochemical point of view, is the 2' hydroxyl of this A here that attaches the bond. Formally, from the biochemical point of view, is called transesterification, because it's an ester that is transferred to another ester. So no energy change. No need of ATP or whatever, okay? Just changing ester bonds, okay? So at this point you have done the first transesterification. So actually the exon, upstream exon, is there. Like it's anchored to one of the U proteins, this nerve, okay? But it's not bound by anything. And this is the lariat, okay? At this point you have the second transesterification, that is, that this OH, that is the terminal part of the exon upstream, it will attach, attack the last bond in between the intron and the exon here. Okay? So you have this that attacks this point here, and so you have the spliced mRNA, and then you leave the intron as a lariat, is released together with the proteins. Okay? So this is the mechanism. There's nothing to do with alternative splicing, just the mechanism of splicing. So, of course, these sequences here that you see in the very first part of the figure, they are the cis determinant of splicing, okay? We call them cis elements, right? Okay? Oh, this that you describe here is the so-called GTAG intron. I don't know if you visited the browser in this detail, but you can visit the browser and see exon and intron. You will always see AT at the beginning of the introns, and GT at the beginning of the introns, AG at the very last one. Okay, there is a secondary type in which the sequence is not conserved. This AT, AT, what is that? I don't remember. ATTG, if I remember well. And these actually is very, very secondary, in the sense that there are only few introns that have a different sequence. And they are taken care by this alternative SNRN that are called U11 and U12. What is the role of the RNA inside this SNRN? I mean, this SNRN has made many proteins together with the RNA molecule, okay? What is the role of this nerve? Actually, in human is not that evident. I mean, in the higher eukaryotes, it's not that evident. Okay, it's mostly a scaffold for the other proteins. Okay, but if you look at the lower eukaryotes, like yeast, for example, you have direct contact between the RNA of this nerve and the branch and the splicing site. Okay, so in the yeast, you have direct RNA-RNA interaction between the RNA U, okay, this nerve component, and the sequence there. Okay, so apparently this RNA evolved as a necessary component to recognize the splicing site. Okay, and then probably it's changed a little bit during evolution. Why RNA? Have you ever heard about autocatalytic enzymes? How many of you have just heard about autocatalytic enzymes? 1, 2, 3, 4. Never. Okay. Some organelles in the lower eukaryotes, okay, like yeast and home, in organelles, the mitochondria and so on, there are enzymes that are capable to excise themselves from the RNA without need of any protein. They are called the ribozymes. Okay? So apparently, to make the story short, apparently the story of splicing evolved from a RNA pure phenomenon and then acquired proteins to change, to populate all the genes and so on. Okay? And this goes in parallel to the fact that yeast have very few introns. We have plenty of introns, and so we have plenty of sequences to deal with, and so the evolution had to change the story to make it complex and complex. Okay? Anyway, this is the reason. Good. The branching site, as you can see, is very poor, extremely poor as a sequence, and actually this is the reason why you have to recognize first with a binding protein, and then to have this nerve again. So you have two-step recognition of this kind of branches. Okay. Alternative splicing, of course, is a problem in which an exon intron is not recognized as a good exon intron. So the first reason why you may have alternative exons is that because they borders are not that good. Okay? You remember that we classified on Monday, we said there are constitutive exons that are always present in the transcripts, okay? And other exons that are called weak or alternative that may be included or not in the message. Okay, so the first main reason why alternative exons are sometimes not included is that they have sequences around there. Okay, the sequences here are less conserved. So, for example, in an alternative exon, you may find that the intron you have the GU is actually enormously conserved. But looking for the other sequence here. Okay, so for example, you have not a purine here, but a pyrimidine. So it makes a little bad site. And so the U2, the U1 SNRP binds with a less affinity to the site. Okay, so if you look at this, so the splice site can be strong or weak depending on how far the sequences diverge from the consensus sequence. That's normal. I mean, for everything is like this, okay? And this will determine the affinity for cognitive splicing factors, okay? So in general, if you have strong splice sites, so if you have really optimal sequence over there, you will have constitutive splicing of that exon intron, okay? This much of the discussion on Pol II elongation rate as a determinant of AS that is made in your review is actually based on this story of strong and weak sites. So try to get the concept very well fixed in your mind. Okay, of course, the sequence that you saw before was just taken from an average situation. But now that we are adult and we have thousands of genes, we can make another bioinformatic, more sophisticated story that is to align, okay, all the thousands borders that we know in all the genes. So if we align everything and try to make as logos of the sequences, you came out with this kind of story. And as you can see, the GT is practically 100% as information content. Okay? So this is also experimental. If you take exon, intron, exon, reporter vector, and then you change the G or the T, it doesn't work anymore. Okay, so this is apparently essential to work. And the same story is true for the AG at the verified 3' plus site here. This AG terminal is practically 100%. Okay? But as you can see, the other position are variable. Okay? So as soon as you go inside the intron, you see that you can have variable situation. There are, okay, preferences like this G, this A, this T, is preferred. Okay? But you can have different stories. Okay? The same is true for the going inside the exon. So you have a G preferred in the minus one position, A preferred in the minus two, and then completely indifferent going back. Okay, so same story on the other border. You have the AG, and then you have only a small leader preference for a G in the first position of the next exon. But otherwise, after that, the preference is completely lost. Okay, and then you see this branch point. The branch point is horribly non-conservative. Horribly, okay? So this is also embarrassing when you make kind of alignment, because it's so different that you cannot really align to something. If you align, for example, to the A, that is the branching site, actually sometimes you find the G, just because probably it's not the correct alignment. You can choose another one, okay? This has been experimentally proven. If you take a reporter, exon, intron, exon, and then you make a mutation of this A, this is not really important. The splicing apparatus will use any other A in the proximity. So in other words, why the GT, AG is absolutely necessary for the color splicing of the intron, the branching point has just to be near the border. No problem. Okay? Good. So we can move. Okay. Also, not please the polypyrimidine tract here. Okay. In this position. Okay. So we can move it. So these are basic components. Okay. So if you don't have the sequences, don't make the splicing, either constitutive or alternative. No splicing at all. Okay. But of course, you can find other regulatory sequences. Okay. Either in the exon or in the intron, there are other cis elements that actually regulate the splicing. So you can find sequence motifs that regulate the user splicing site, and they are named after their location and effect. So you find exonic sequences. This first E stands for exonic. And then you can have sequences that have a positive effect on the splicing or negative effect on the splicing. So you call them exonic splicing enhancers or exonic splicing silencers. And you find also sequences that are intronic. Okay, so you find the same story. Intronic splicing enhancer and intronic splicing silencer. We call them cis elements for splicing regulation. Okay, of course, these elements that are found in exon and introns correspond to proteins that we call transacting factors, of course, proteins that bind to these elements. And essentially, there are three categories of proteins like this. The first is SR proteins. They are named after funny story. So they are actually splicing regulators. So SR stands for splicing regulators. And they are characterized from the structural point of view having a RS domain, that means arginine and serine. So I just changed the two letters, okay? SR, RS domain, okay, anyway. So the second one is HNRP, that is an enormous, huge group of proteins. HNRP stands for heterogeneous nuclear ribonuclear proteins. This is kind of name, this funny name, that actually came from the very first ancient, 50 years ago, classification of these proteins. So. And then finally, we have a third category that are tissue-specific and context-specific factors. Okay. So these proteins are general. SR proteins and HNRNP are always found bound to any kind of RNA. So they are general splicing factors, even though they are not component of the splices. Okay. So what do they do? Okay, first, SR protein, splicing regulators, this RS domain is typical. They usually, mi sono seduto nel posto sbagliato. Ok, dicevo che, come si fa? Cioè uno continua a tenerlo schiacciato e lui cosa fa? Fa quello che vuole, intelligenza artificiale. Dai. Ok. This SR are phosphorylated at serine by several kinases, so they are regulated by pathways and so, okay. And also interact with the CAP binding protein, with the poly A binding protein, so they have a kind of complex interaction with all the components of RNA metabolism. And then they bind essentially to mostly at exons. Okay, so you usually find this protein bound to the exon, sometimes also to the introgen, rather, okay. And usually they have a positive action. So they are bound to an exon or to an intron close to an exon. In that case, the exon will be included. So they are positive regulators of splice. Okay? These are all the proteins that we know, this kind. Okay, so as you can see, there are nine SR protein in the higher vertebrates. They present domains that is common motif. RRM is a common motif for binding RNA, and this is the binding sequence, as you can see. So sometimes it's long, sometimes it's short. Anyway, any of those has a binding preference. Okay. Forget these target genes because it's an old story. And then we have other proteins that are so-called SR-like, in the sense that they have also an arginine serine domain, but they are different from the structural point of view. And these are the list. Just tell you that this TRA2 beta, they are very important just because historical reason, because they are the very first splicing factor discovered in Drosophila several years ago. The name TRA derives from a gene in Drosophila that is transformer, and that transforms male in female. So it's kind of story, very cryptic story. Okay, so that's this historical name, and that's it. So HNRP proteins, many different subfamilies, usually bind intronic sites, so on the difference, okay, the SR were exonic, these are intronics, and they are mainly carrying out intron definition. And several other roles have been ascribed to individual members, for example, cytoplasmic localization or in neurons, axonic localization of messenger RNA, other stories. These are the small catalog of the different subclasses. You see that the name is the same, then you have A1, A2, B1. This is a structural classification, so don't go in the specific. Okay. Just note some of them, for example, this PTB, that is very important because actually it binds to the polypyrimidine tract binding. The name PTB stands for polypyrimidine tract binding. and these are component of all the splicing, okay? And just note, for example, this HNLPL, that is a splicing factor, actually. So it binds to introns, blah, blah. But host cells are all in chromatin maintenance. They found associated to many chromatin metabolism enzymes. Okay, also for many of those, we know the sequence. Binding sometimes is only very undefined sequence, like C and A rich, that doesn't mean anything, or means few things. Or this one, the C1, that binds to U rich sequences, but also in this case, it's not really a sequence. Okay. Good, so finally, what we know of this messenger RNA, or pre-messenger RNA, is that it's a kind of molecule in which you find the CBC, that is the cap binding complex to the 5 prime, okay? Then you find SR proteins, mainly at the exons, okay? And then you find the long introns that are usually covered by H and L and P complexes. Okay. Sometimes, occasionally, you can find a regulator of the same class, HN and P proteins, also binding to exon. And not in the picture, but I tell you, sometimes you can find also SR protein introns, usually close to the exons. Okay? So this is the story. So just to make a scheme, okay, you have this cis element that we described before, so ESE, ESS, ISE, and ISS, and they are bound by either HNRNP proteins or by SR protein. SR proteins always have a arrow because they are positive regulator of splicing. These green are as nerves, so positive effect on the splicing components binding to the borders, while HNRNP, they have usually minors. They are a kind of inhibitor. Okay? Good. So, making the story a little in the context, just before moving on, is that imagine that this one is a has a very corrupted sequence at the borders. You remember what we said before. Whenever the sequence at the intron border is suboptimal, okay, this site will be called weak. Imagine to have the same situation here. So at the border exon intron here, you have also a weak site. So in basal status, this exon will probably be skipped, okay? So it's a skipped exon, because the apparatus recognizes this, will recognize the following one here, so it will skip it, okay? But here we have a ESC, so a exonic splicing enhancer, okay? If the protein SR is correctly expressed and phosphorylated, okay, it will bind to this ESC, and it will help the spliceosome recognizing this border and this border. Okay? So the exon will be included. Now imagine the other situation around. You have an exon that on default can be included, so it has quite good size on the borders. Okay? But you get this ESS. So this sequence is present in the exon. And this protein here is expressed, HNRP something, A1 number, I don't know what, okay, is expressed, is phosphorylated, is activated, it binds to it, and it will exert negative influence on the spliceosome there, and then you skip it. Okay, so you have this kind of regulation on the stories, okay? What to say? Okay. Last thing that not always they. I mean, for this kind of regulation, very often you have direct interaction, protein-protein interaction between the SR protein and SNRPs. Okay, so you have direct contact. Sometimes this content is not direct, and several co-activators of splicing have been described in the past. So sometimes you have a bridging protein between the contexts. Okay. So this is true. In your review, there are several examples of this SR-mediated or HNRNP-mediated regulation of splicing events. Okay, but actually, these proteins, HNRNP proteins and SR, are ubiquitous. If you look at through the tissues and cells and whatever, they are always expressed in almost all cell types. And so the consequence is that how can a protein that is always expressed in all cell types justify tissue-specific splicing? It's hard to understand, okay? It's like having a transcription factors. If you have transcription factor expressed in all cell types, how you can imagine that you have specific enhancer expressed in some cells and not in others, okay? So that's the concept. So people started to look for specific factors. In other words, factors that are expressed only in certain cell types or tissue types that can justify this kind of tissue-specific alternative splice. Okay, and this is a long story because there are many kind of assay that the people use it to understand. But I just want to show you the very last one today experiment because it's quite interesting. It makes another kind of approach to the genomic stories. Is that the reasoning is? Most of the time, if you take two species like human and mouse that are quite close, as you know, from the genomic point of view, not really much, but anyway, quite close, okay? There are many sequences that are conserved. Of course, if you look at the coding sequence, they are very conserved. But if you look to non-coding, so regulatory sequences, they are quite conserved, okay? So you can compare the genomes of mouse and human to look for alternative exons and constitutive exons. In addition, both human and mouse genomes have been quite thoroughly studied by Phantom Project, ENCODE Project, and so on. So you have RNA data, you can compare, okay? So the people, what they did was to take all the exons from human and mouse that are homologous and that they were consistently alternative in the two species, and another library of exons that are constitutive in both human and mouse. Okay? And they compared the conservation. Okay? So they compared the phylogenetic conservation of those. So they did this. It seems complicated, but it's not very, very complicated indeed. So they took all the exons, okay? This is exon. And since they are different length, they normalized them. Okay? Normalized means that they took section of X nucleotides and divided in 10 sections. Each exon was divided in 10 sections. Okay? Longest, shorter. And then they considered the 200 bases flanking in the intron, okay? Here, and 200 on the right side of each exon, okay? And they compared all the constitutive exons in human that have an homolog in mouse, okay? And this is the degree of identity. Okay, so they counted the position of conservation in the two species. Okay. So they found that this is the conservation inside the exons, okay, more or less 50-something percent, flat in all the positions of the exon. they found that there was 100% of conservation here in the border, but you know that, because the border, as you remember, is the two letters is fixed, okay, in the border entrance. So you are 100%, and then you fall down as a conservation as far as you enter in the entrance. Same story on the right, okay? And they compared this situation with alternative exons. Okay, so they have a library of exons in the other side. So they compared mouse and human, and look at the results. You see that these are alternative exons. And as you can see, inside the exon, what do you see? This is the degree of conservation in alternative exons. You see that? How much it is? 75. How much it was? A little less than 60. So in other words, if you compare the sequences of exons, constitutive exons, with conservation that you find in alternative exons, you find that alternative exons are usually more conserved inside. I stop here for a moment and ask your opinion. What does it mean? I mean, it's usually what they do, exons, internal exons, usually they are encoding, right? So is it expected that you have different degree of conservation inside the exons when you compare constitutive and alternative? Does it make sense? Do this mean that the coding capacity is so changing here? Sorry, so changing here in the constitutive exon than in this part? Okay, so this is linked to the fact that, as you remember, the genetic code is redundant. So a single amino acid can be encoded by various combinations, as you remember. So it's true that if you have to make homologous exon, probably this coding sequence in terms of amino acid probably doesn't change much, okay, between human and mouse, okay? But this is probably due to the changing third letter of the code, or the second one. Okay, so the combination and encoding. But also means that probably inside the exon you should have sequences like the ones that we saw before. So ESC, so exonic splice enhancer, that actually make an alternative exon to be regulated. While the constitutive exon doesn't need any sequence more, because it is just to rely on the good sequences on the borders. Okay? So no need to have additional elements in the constitutive exon. Yes, need to have it inside. The same situation, if you look, the conservation in the intronic sequence is exactly the same. As you can see, the conservation for constitutive exon falls down very rapidly. If you look at the borders of constitutive exon, while in alternative exon, as you can see, it goes farther away. You see there. So again, this probably means that in the region of the intron you may have intronic regulators, okay, and then they are conserved evolutionarily because they serve something, okay? So this is the reason. Then they found also some other interesting things, and then I will conclude. The first is that look at the symmetrical versus non-symmetrical composition of these exons. Do you know what is symmetrical in splicing, considering exons and introns? Symmetrical means that it's a multiple of 3. So it means that the length of the exon may be 30, 33, 60, 90, 93. Okay, multiple of 3. Means that when you exclude or include the exon, you don't introduce a shift in the frame. They are called cassette exons. So they are, you can put and remove, not changing in the frame. Okay? But look at the percentage. It's fantastic. in constitutive exons, so the exons that are always part of the message, there is no real pressure to be symmetrical or asymmetrical, okay? While in the alternative exon, this is very important. And so you have a large fraction that the alternative exons that are symmetrical. Okay, so that's very, very nice. And also other things, like, for example, you have the mean length, average length, you see that the constitutive exons apparently are much longer on average than the alternative ones. Okay. And also look at this, the length of introns. Usually constitutive exons have introns that are shorter than the alternative ones. Okay, so there are many differences that can distinguish alternative and constitutive exons. And also this suggests, the conservation fact suggests that alternative exons are always accompanied by regulatory sequences, either in the introns or inside the exon itself. Okay, so this is the conclusion. So this is the very last slide today, feature of alternative versus constitutive. More conserved, the exons that are alternative spliced are more conserved than constitutive exon. That means cis regulatory sequence. Okay. They are usually cassette exons. They have very weak splice site. They are shorter and they are symmetric. Okay? So good. Today we are done. Just to remember that tomorrow we are switching with bioinformatics. Okay, so.